Many people have a desire to enter the world of investing, whether it be through real estate, stocks, or entrepreneurship. However, people often face self-doubt, a limited belief system, or simply a lack of knowledge to put behind their ambition. It's easier than you think to overcome these obstacles if you know exactly what's holding you back. Partner with Andre to forge new neurological pathways that unlock breakthrough strategies for income generation, reshape your belief systems, and construct your desired life. With over 15 years of experience in finance and a decade devoted to teaching wealth preservation, these achievements are no mere coincidence. One thing is clear, if others have done it, you can too. Start your complimentary action plan today at www.andrestewartauthor.com. Welcome to the Investing Uncensored podcast. If you've been searching for ways to break free from the 9-to-5 grind, scale or start your own business, generate passive income, or gain insights from others who have achieved their desired lifestyle, get ready. Prepare to be inspired as we provide you with invaluable tips, resources, and firsthand experiences from Andre and other industry experts who have accomplished remarkable things in their respective fields. This is the Investing Uncensored podcast, your roadmap to success. And now here's your host, Andre Stewart.
Welcome to Investing Uncensored. I'm your host, Andre Stewart. And today I'm bringing you guys a great guest. He has a phenomenal background. Since I have a startup, I thought it would be a great idea to bring on someone who has a startup background. And he has VC background as well. And you know, for the past couple of weeks, I've been bringing on a lot of VCs. So it'd be interesting to hear what he has to say about both environments. So Ryan, how are you doing?
Yeah, you know, they say you have to be a VC, but nobody's perfect. I'm great. Thanks for having me in the pod. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ryan, we just had a quick conversation about where you are. You're in my favorite state, Florida. Tell us a little bit more about how you got to Florida.
The long way. It started in Canada, then Europe for about 7 years, and then New York for a long time, about another 7 years. And now I'm down in Florida, so I kind of took the scenic route.
Have you been to any of those soccer games? You know, Messi just got there.
Yeah, no, you know what's funny? So my son has like a WhatsApp group for his class and I'm in the parents group. And every once in a while we see a parent is like, oh, hey, listen, I got tickets to Messi play, but I can't go. Does anybody want to get these tickets off my hand? And it's like super duper exciting. But so far the couple times it's happened, we've been out of town or couldn't make it or something. So I'm just waiting for the right chance. But it's really, really cool situation, Messi. I think the startup part of it, one of the underrated parts is that Messi is actually getting what's essentially under a structure, from what I understand, it's like equity basically in the team, right? Which is kind of unusual under a sports contract.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's kind of a weird thing to do, but it makes a ton of sense, right? And like, you know, I guess it's funny how you have that mechanism in startups, right? So like everyone takes startup options is like a very common thing. You know, in movies, you know, a lot of the stars will get a piece of the residuals, for instance. So like there's participation on the upside. But it's funny because in sports, it's still mostly fixed salary. And I'm wondering if that's going to change over the years as people like Messi negotiate those into contracts.
I mean, that's actually a really good idea. I didn't even know he did that. But now that you say that, I think like players like LeBron or like franchise players should be able to get an equity stake. That's a good idea. So he might be the 100%. Trailblazer for that idea. You know what I mean?
I can see it changing. Yeah, maybe this is like the start of change.
With that being said, so give us a little bit about your background and how you got into startups and what made you, you know, leave the VC space, but also what was your experience like as being a VC?
You know, there's a little Peter Thiel rule, right? When you're valuing a startup acquihire, you add $1 million for every engineer and you subtract $1 million for every MBA. Well, I've got an MBA and 2 engineering degrees, so I'm still net positive, but barely. And yeah, my background, I was in, you know, in Canada, I was an engineer. In the UK, I was a VC. When I went to New York is when I founded Zenlytic. And Miami, I'm still, you know, running analytics. So that's the short story. B2BC was awesome. Yeah, it's a really, really great job.
Mm-hmm.
As far as jobs go, it's about as good as it gets. It's very interesting as a job. You know, like you meet the most inspiring people. You get to be on the bleeding edge of really cool ideas, right? You get to predict the future, which is like, how many jobs can you predict the future? And like, it's a really, really fascinating job. It's also like, you know, just good work-wise. It's one of those participate in the outside jobs, which I think is kind of, you know, important to take strategically. I think it's good to aspire in a career. He's like, look for, you know, participation in the upside. So it's kind of like being messy in a job, really. No, I'm kidding. The funny thing that people don't understand about VC is it's a very, very thin line between VC and startup land, right? So like when people think about VC, they usually bundle it in with all the other sort of finance groups. And it's like, there's like a giant sort of you know, there's a stack where it like starts with like infrastructure investing or then real estate and then LBOs or mid-market and whatever, growth stage investing all the way down to venture. And venture is usually viewed as like the smallest side of that stack, but I think it's actually be viewed as the end of the startup stack. It's actually a completely different like set, and it's like closer to being an entrepreneur than being an infrastructure investor.
Why do you say that? Because of the standpoint of having to raise funds as well, or what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first, because a lot of the methodologies they use elsewhere in that stack are pretty consistent. So like, you know, infrastructure investors and real estate investors and, you know, they all kind of look at cap rates or whatever, or IRR, like it's kind of the same methodology, but those kind of break down in venture stages. You know, like it's hard to actually value something on revenue multiples when you're at the pre-seed stage, you have no revenue. So like, it doesn't work that way. And you know, the biggest thing is actually though, because people tend to go back and forth across the table, as they say. And like, I used to teach a course on venture at my old B school, and I'd go in there, I'd do it once a year. I'd go in and I'd be like, okay, who wants to be a VC here? And like a sea of hands would raise up. And then I'd say, okay, now who wants to be an entrepreneur? And kind of like, you know, like half of the hands would go down, and I'd like feel like stinger. And it's like, so listen, if you put your hand down for the entrepreneur part, you probably don't want to think about being a VC as well, because they're two sides of the same coin, you know? Whether you're giving the money or whether you're taking the money, you're still, you know, like on the fringe of building these businesses. There's actually a bit of a crossover point. I think the purest advice actually is if you want to be a senior VC someday, you should probably start off by being an entrepreneur. If you want to be a seasoned serial entrepreneur someday, you should start off as a VC associate. And then, you know, kind of at the midway of our career, they often switch, which is kind of fun. So yeah, it's a great job. You're constantly pulled towards being a founder. Like you meet the most inspirational people, like I said, and you're like, man, I would love to be doing that. And then you start to see where the streams converge, right? So you see, oh man, like if you took that product with this company's, you know, head of DevOps, where this company's CMO and this company's go-to-market strategy, you know, that would be an absolute juggernaut of a business. And you start to think, well, you know, maybe I should start doing things like this and putting these pieces together now. And it's hard to resist the pull to cross the table, basically, once you start being a VC, even though it's one of the best jobs you can get. That's why I say it's as good as it gets in terms of jobs.
I think people don't know how VCs work. I think they just think it's a bunch of people with a bunch of money, but they have to go out there and raise the funds from other people, right? To be able to invest that money. It's not like, it's like the 10 founders just have $100 million sitting around, right? They go out and raise the funds. Yeah. And they have to put a return on the funds that they're borrowing, right? In order to get the funds in the first place.
100%. One thing that people don't understand is actually VC is, unfortunately, this is true of a lot of jobs in finance, I think. VC is a perfect example of it though, is that in a way it gets less fun as you get more senior in it. And the reason that I say that is because when you first start out, you get to spend all your time investing and working with startups, right? Which is the funnest part of the job.
Right.
But then as you get more and more senior, it becomes your job to go out and raise the funds. And then, you know, then you're basically, you're selling again, right? You're selling the fund. And it's fun selling, you know, it's very, very like operating at sort of high level type of selling. It's very collaborative selling. You're not sticking your foot in doors, you know, like pushing vacuum cleaners or anything like that. But it's still a sales role. And it's still not as fun as investing in the future of X and helping build businesses and, you know, build those businesses on the leading edge. So yeah, that happens in a lot of sort of, you know, finance related roles where you spend more time selling as you get more senior. But I think that that's especially true for VC. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's fun to do it at the start and then go on. If you're going to be selling stuff, you'd also be selling stuff for your own business anyway. So
then you have in a background on the tech side, the VC side, now you're a CEO. Which side do you like the most?
I should probably say the CEO side, but you know what? I think personally, my personal preference is I like the tech side.
Oh, okay.
For better or worse. It's funny, actually. This just happened. I was just posting on Twitter about RAG, Retrieval Augmented Generation, which is this LLM technique, which gets pretty technical. And someone hopped in and they're like, wow, Ryan is like a real technical CEO.
Exactly. And it's so rare.
Yeah, I know, right? It's all fun. I just get a CEO because I am the least skilled technical person on the team. Yeah, I built a Linux original front end, and then they were like, they wouldn't let me code anymore after that. Like, Ryan, you should be the CEO. And yeah, so like someone jumped on Twitter and they're like, yeah, well, it's like, you're still technical. And I was going to reply, actually. It's funny because like the open secret in the team or like at Zenlytic is that like, yeah, I kind of just drew the short straw as a CEO because I'm the least good technically. But if I were to choose like a single job in the Zenlytic to be doing right now, out of just pure personal interest sake, I'd probably be giving myself ahead of LLM's role. You know, so the person whose job it is to deploy and train and configure all these LLMs, which I think is just really cool tech. I'm a big nerd for sure. I've always, you know, I just love the technical stuff and I get a lot of satisfaction from just coding and building and, you know, being an IC. But duty calls, being a CEO is fun too. It's you know, never a dull moment. So I'm happy to be at the helm of Zenlytic too.
That's the part about it. Like being a CEO, I think, you know, there's this, obviously this misconception of like, everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Everybody wants to run a company. But like, do you really want to run a company and the stress that comes behind that? Because being a CEO or being a CTO, two different things, right? The CEO has to basically wear a thousand hats, right? And it's like, it's so much easier to be able to just be one thing versus eight things. So your experience as CEO, first of all, give us a little bit about what Zenlytic is. And then your experience as a CEO, you know what I mean? What's the least thing you like about being a CEO and the you know, the best thing about it?
Yeah, for sure. So what Zenlytic is we're a business intelligence tool. And in fact, we're the world's first self-serve business intelligence tool, which, you know, I think a lot of tools out there might claim to be self-serve, but what they usually mean there is like, you know, kind of the static dashboarding experience. And if you want to go anywhere deeper than that, if you want to sort of, you know, ask questions about what's on your dashboards or, you know, sort of pivot around or filter, just look any deeper on that. Usually you see these little SQL windows popping up and you have to understand, you know, what a join key is and it gets gnarly fast. So, you know, if you're using a non-self-serve business intelligence tool, you find yourself emailing data teams a lot, the quick data pull. And those quick data pulls are never quick. They can take days or weeks, basically. Very frictiony for both sides of that equation. The way the world's first self-serve BI tool is that we've used AI and LLMs to sort of infuse the tool with this sort of, you know, chat native AI business analyst. They can answer all your questions. And her name's Zoe. And you can just go on and you can say anything from like, hey, Zoe, like, why were our Facebook revenues down last week? And she'll run an analysis for you through to, hey, Zoe, can you tell us, you know, our sales, you know, by channel this month and then maybe compare it to the same time last year? And she'll go and pull that response for you in a couple seconds. So it's much, much faster, easier way to get access to your data than traditional tools.
Let's pause there with the AI for a second. As we mentioned earlier, you have an AI and we just integrated one as an AI investment advisor. Her name is Athi. Athi and Zoe need to meet up so they can be friends.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm curious, we had a big debate internally whether or not we should give Zoe a name or not, or just make her this analytic chatbot. And I'm curious if y'all had the same discussion, the same debate, or did you know it was going to be a personified chatbot?
No, you know what? I was thinking the same thing. I was like, we should just let it be a chatbot. But I was like, making it or giving it a name just makes it more personal to the person using it. And that's kind of why we went with the name. I don't know why we chose a female name. I don't know, but it just made sense. And I don't know. Athena? Athena? I was just like, hey.
Great name.
But what about you guys? What made you guys choose them?
You know, I was like slightly pro on it. We were all kind of like, there are differing opinions. In the end, we chose to do it just because it's easy to talk about it, you know? And like, if we want to talk about the Zenlytic, you know, data chatbot or something, that's a mouthful and it's kind of boring. We just say, you know, Zoe can make a dashboard now. So like, this is easy to talk about, you know, it's more for pragmatic reasons. We chose Zoe. It's actually a throwback to the original LLMs. So like, I don't know if you know this, but my co-founder and I actually met studying AI in like 2017, and like the GPT-2 pre-GPT architectures were all named after Sesame Street characters. So there was, you know, there's Elmo was like one of the first ones, and there was Bert, and then there was Ernie. And we said, oh, we got to do a Sesame Street character for our name, like as like an homage to the original language models. And there was only one character with a Z that we found, and it was Zoe. So, and she happened to be female, same thing, but like, you know, so Zoe was born.
That's pretty cool, man. I like that. I didn't even know the backstory behind the names for the language models. That's crazy.
Oh.
With that being said, did you guys use ChatGPT or you guys created your own language model?
We've experimented with both. So we've tested everything extensively. So like we've worked with all of the commercial available models from OpenAI, from Anthropic, from Google. We've tried our own models. We've tried fine-tuning our own models. And the end result is that like, it's actually a single call to Zoe. Zoe is actually like an amalgamation of like, I think we're up at three different agents now, but like a number of different models that have been optimized for either speed or comprehension or a certain task.
Mm-hmm.
And then those kind of come together to look like a single AI call. I will say some of the hardest parts of the model, some of the most comprehension heavy parts of it, we rely on GPT-4, I think, which is to date still the, in my opinion, the highest quality comprehension. That might have changed today. Actually, I know that Google re-released the Bard update, which I haven't had a chance to see. I don't know if my team has tried it out yet or not. But I think for now, in terms of overall like quality, kind of, you know, ability to understand or sort of like, you know, human likeness, I feel like it's hard to beat GPT-4 still.
Yeah, that's what we're using too. I like GPT-4. We were looking at Perplexity, but Perplexity doesn't have AI. So we're going to, in the process of creating our own language model so we can use it for, like you said, kind of like the analytic. So with yours, do you guys plan on creating API so other people can use it, or is it just going to be something that you're going to have in-house?
Oh yeah, it's fully available basically. It's you can go to demo.dinlink.com and play with it right now if you want. All of our users use it. It's you know, our most popular feature basically within the tool. So everyone loves Zoe.
So then let's dive into that a little bit more, because we need to use a tool that we can take our user data and have it recommend properties based on people's like financial income, their savings account, whatever they have in their bank account and places they like to travel. And then it will recommend properties to them, say it's in Portugal or say it's in Colombia. Would something like that work with Zenlytic?
Great. This podcast just became a sales call. double time. Look, I'm getting two for one here. This is amazing. Yes. Let me bring up our pricing. Yes, it can do that.
Okay.
So like the way we work is we sit on top of a cloud data warehouse. So think like Snowflake or, you know, BigQuery, the big two, but you see stuff like Redshift and any SQL compatible warehouse, basically, and you connect the tool to it and it answers the questions. Yeah. So like it actually does two things. It's a combination of an LLM plus something called a semantic layer, which is like a list of all the metrics that you want to track and all the dimensions you want to flex by and whatever. You know, then the semantic layer goes and translates your business questions into SQL queries to run against that data warehouse. And yes, absolutely. That's exactly what it's built to do with stuff like that.
That's what my next question, what industry specific, or is it just any person, any company, any industry can use it?
Yeah, it is industry agnostic. It's funny you ask that, because at the start of the year, our website actually said, you know, AI powered BI for the commerce industry, for direct to consumer businesses and retail. That was where we started. There was never actually anything in the product that was specific to commerce, right? It was like the only industry specific stuff happened, and that's magic layer. So to change that, you're not changing products like, you know, app code, you're just changing a configuration file. We started out in commerce though, because we really wanted to force ourselves to like understand the problems of the user, right? And like, in my opinion, one of the biggest problems in data right now is that data teams don't think enough about how data is going to be consumed and used and understood. And by saying we're only commerce, it let us really focus on what, you know, what the problems were, like how they think about, you know, conversion rates and cart abandonment and, you know, advertising excellence, ROAS and PROAS, and like this, the sort of things that they think about every day, and let us sort of live in their shoes. Once we started to grow, we felt comfortable that the product was sort of ready for prime time, and we opened it up and we said, okay, we're now a prod-based tool. And yeah, so now we work with a large variety of industries, some of the bigger heads. Still commerce, still always be a big part of what we do. It's the oldest part for sure. Probably where we get the most referrals. Financial services. Unexpected for me, actually. I thought they'd be a later sort of like segment, but they're actually late. one of the first and the biggest. Yeah. But a lot of people are excited about this in financial services. SaaS, I think, is probably the third. So big SaaS businesses, lots of data, lots to analyze. Consumer tech, health tech is a big vertical. Yeah, a little bit of everything.
But what are you guys using? I hope I'm not giving away your secret sauce, but what are you guys using when someone dumps the data in? So for instance, if you have a real estate platform and then you have a person who sells fruits, how is this API or how is the Zoe going to use my data and give it back to me? You know what I mean? Is there like a machine learning component to it, or like how's that working?
So that's where the semantic layer comes in, actually. And the semantic layer lets you, you know, if you're a fruit stand, you can say, hey, listen, the total amount of fruit sold is the sum of this fruit sold column in my fruit sold table. Or if you're a real estate advisor, you can say, hey, you know what, the cap rate on this property is stored in, you know, cap rates of this table. And essentially the semantic layer just points out to, okay, here's the important things. Here's what we call it. We call it cap rate. Here's the description. And then the AI goes and reads all of that, including the text and the names and the SQL formulas, and figures out, you know, what's important. And, you know, when you're asking a question, it figures out what's relevant for you, basically.
Interesting. Oh, and yeah. Then it can shoot out the information like, hey, you should invest in Portugal based on information that you gave us.
Yeah, you can. I mean, it's to a certain extent, it will make recommendations. Mm-hmm. We're actually trying to keep it from making recommendations, which is interesting. Okay. So like we try, our primary objective right now is what I would call descriptive, which mm-hmm. is like, here is your data, right? And like there's, I think that's actually like the most effective way to do this is effortless access to a domain expert. And even though these LLMs are very, very smart, I feel like as humans, we can still make better recommendations once we're given the data. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example of that. Actually, my wife and I were, just when GPT-4 came out, I was sort of showing it off to my wife. And she's also an entrepreneur. She runs a dating business. Mm-hmm. And a dating site. And I said, oh, look, I'm going to write some marketing copy for you using this new thing called ChatGPT. And I said, you know, write me, you know, marketing copy for a dating site for people of East Asian descent living in America, which is her TAM, basically. And it wrote like, you know, about like 10 little strap lines for like a Facebook ad. And I read them and I was like, pretty good. She's going to be impressed. And I was like, look at these, honey. And I was trying to show off ChatGPT, and she looked and she was like, this LLM really doesn't understand our market at all. And I was like, interesting. So I was like, I was interested that she wasn't impressed by it. I was more interested that it looked good to both me and the LLM. So it's not even necessarily a human LLM thing, but it's like a domain expertise, right? Mm-hmm. And so she's spent the last 5 years thinking about how to communicate to her target users. I have not, neither has, you know, ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. So even though it's a very powerful tool, we just want to present the data to an expert and let the expert make the decision. So that's why I think descriptive is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. We might do more prescriptive in the future, but actually what I'm most interested in is proactive instead of reactive, right? And what I mean by that is that, you know, so now you can go on and you can log into Zoe and you can say, hey, you know, what's been driving, what was my churn last week? And she can give it to you and whatever. Imagine if you logged in and it was like, yo, hey, Andre, like, welcome back. It's been 6 days since you last logged in. You know, since you last logged in, your sales are on track, on plan, and they're like, you know, on pace for the month. So you should be fine there. I know you were asking about, you know, churn rate. Last time you logged in, you should know that your churn rate spiked up by 3% this weekend. You know, do you want to investigate what's happening with that? And it could actually move from you asking for information to it pushing it, you know, and saying, here's what you need to know, basically. And I think that will be a really powerful thing that just that straddles that, like, you know, still, you know, makes you the domain expert. You make the decisions, but it doesn't just pull the information, it pushes the information to you. That's, I think it's going to make some like, kind of, yeah, superhuman. So that's really where we spend a lot of time thinking about. And that'll become a part of the platform before too long here.
That's pretty amazing. And are you guys, you got to be using the internet through ChatGPT to get like updated information, I'm assuming.
So we use the API for our calls. We have privacy centric versions as well. So yeah, working in data is important. There's several solutions to that. Some of our larger users have the enterprise version of ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. So they have their own internal, like, private cloud version. So they can, you know, we can run with that. And then it's all entirely run on a private cloud. We also have a privacy-centric version that only uses the semantic layer to prevent any sensitive data being sent out to ChatGPT. And like the only thing that it needs to send out, because we have the semantic layer, the only thing that the AI actually sees is like, if you ask about whatever your sales, the AI will see that you have a metric named gross revenue, but it will not see any of the data involved with that. It won't see what your gross revenue is. It won't see the constituent components of your gross revenue, whatever. Those just don't like get sent to the AI at all. Those are all handled inside the semantic layer in traditional computing. So like,
which is very important for privacy reasons, right?
Totally. Yeah. 100%. And especially you think about things like, you know, GDPR and CCPA and like, it gets complicated really fast. So yeah, we've worked hard to make sure that privacy is preserved. That's especially important for like a BI data tool.
100%.
Ever wished you had the opportunity to buy a stock like Facebook, Amazon, or Netflix before it went public or was able to get shares in companies like VC firms and angel investors? Well, here's your chance. Go to investfar.com/invest and reserve a position. For the next 1 to 3 months, InvestFAR is allowed a limited number of low-cost shares be available for friends, family, and its community per SEC regulations before it goes public. Imagine being able to 1,000x or 10,000x your investment, like the top 5%. With exclusive opportunities such as this, positions are limited and the window of time is short. Don't miss your chance. That's INV, as in Victor, ESTFAR.com/invest.
So with that being said, you know, anybody with a startup, I know how that would benefit a startup, because the more data you have in the beginning is for you to be able to know where to dump more money, right? So yeah, why do you think, or where do you think this tool would fit in with the startup? And, you know, just give us your expertise on like your startup background and why this would be good to implement in a startup from the beginning.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's I would actually put it from the very beginning because of the one prerequisite that we have, which is that data warehouse, right? So like if you're a 1 to 10 person startup, you're probably not going to have your Snowflake set up and we have nothing to connect to. And then, you know, you can't make bricks without clay, as they say. So I'd say that like the time that it starts to make sense to think about us is when you think about any BI tool, which is probably by the time you're, you know, 30, 40, 50 people is usually when people install their first BI tool. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, it makes a lot of sense. And then the reason for that is that's the time when you know, intuition becomes like harder, basically. Once there's more people in the organization moving in different directions, no one has a clear picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, that's also when you become big enough to collect enough data that has signals on how you can do your job better, right?
Right.
Now, we have lots of different use cases for Zoolytic. I'd say probably the most common that we see is sort of sales and marketing. So for instance, you know, picture if your startup had an end-to-end view of your marketing and sales conversion, right? So it started with everything from here's what your website traffic looks like. Here's how they use the website. Here's where they stay on. Here's the sites. Here's where they bounce, et cetera, et cetera. When they stay on that website, here's how they convert. And here's, you know, here's where they go to click to get a demo. Here's the one where they go to the sign up for the free trial. This is the conversion rate for that. Here are the people that sign up on each of those. And you know, you get more data on that. And you go through to, all right, here's the free trials that convert. Here are the product queue that they use. The people that convert tend to use features X, Y, and Z, the impressive features. You know, if really go to the demo and it's like, you know, people are, whatever, from these following industries and these size, like these are your ideal customers here. They're going to get excited about the demo. Maybe move to a free trial. You have that converting all the way through to, you know, becoming a buyer of your product. Then even beyond that, I suppose, too, it's like, all right, here's the people that come and, you know, resubscribe the next year. The people, this is what drives, you know, the successful one versus the churn ones. Here are the ways you identify who's at risk for churn, right? And it's like, all right, it turns out that if, you know, people go to your app marketplace, they download the following three apps, like apparently those are really bad because those companies have a higher risk of churning next year when it's time for contract renewal, whatever, right? So like, you can just see, yeah, very few companies have all of that information for starters. No. And being able to see it end to end, just watch how it flows through and then like, you know, ask questions about that and drill in where you want and double click on the drivers. You can see how you can improve like every single step in that funnel. If drastically.
It's like Google Analytics on steroids, right?
Yeah, that's exactly clear. Yeah.
And if people don't use like Google Analytics, you know, like when you look at Google Analytics, yeah, you're like, whoa, it has all of this information from the user journey. Like it tells you way too much. But then what you're saying is just like times 10, which is way more important data you need, because you need to know where this person was on this page for 1 minute. Then they went here. Then it's converted. Like that's intense, man.
Right.
That's really good.
And you can just go in and type with those questions instead of having like, it's like Google Analytics. It's like an airplane cockpit or something like that.
You're where, clicking around.
You know, you have no idea. Blinking lights everywhere. And there's like, yeah, knobs and levers, and you're like, is this a warning alarm or is this everything's okay alarm? And like, yeah, no, it's you just ask it. It's like texting a really smart person that just, you know, lives inside your data warehouse and never sleeps. And can reply in like 2 seconds. So that's our objective. And,
this is pretty amazing. If anybody's listening, like you need to go check this out, because you need analytics to run a business. And you just have to, because if not, you're just gonna be spinning your wheels and you're not gonna have that much growth. But like using something like this, it can probably take your growth. Just what do you think? I don't know if you talk to your clients. What's their growth been since they've integrated your product? It has to be like exponential.
Yeah. So absolutely. I mean, people have great growth. It's hard to attribute that directly to us. To be fair, the number we usually look for, though, is two things. First, it's like the really, really tactical one is like, how fast are your questions answered? And we've clocked it and we found an increase of about 1,200 times faster. So people get answers to that data really fast. The other one that we really watch is how many of those quick data pulls happen, which I meant is like, you know, like you got like a data person on your team or an analyst. And if you find yourself always asking them, hey, can I learn more about this? Tell me about this. I want to run a project on this. And you go to them and then they come back with the information later. You know, that's the pain point. And the official number is, we say it reduces it by 75%, the number of quick data pulls, the number of like, you know, time dip to go to ask the person. You know, when we ask people, they usually say anywhere from 80 to low 90s type percent is kind of their outcome. But officially, we say 75%.
What? Yes, we're talking, man. Yeah. After this, it is a sales call. So you guys also just raised two rounds of funding. So you going from a VC to having your own business and then raising two rounds of funding. What was that like? Was it easy because you were already in the space and you had those connections? Or did you have to do like a normal startup and pitch 50 to 60 to 75 VCs? How'd that go?
So I would say, it's funny, I didn't actually use any of my VC connections to pitch either of our rounds. They're both kind of people that I've met since I became a founder. I would say I had a slightly easier time because I can talk the language as a VC. I know how to position this stuff and make it sound exciting. I had a harder time because I haven't spent 10 years as a head of BI for a corporation, which is like living the life of our user, right? I just spent less time doing that. So, you know, net, I'd say maybe slightly easier. I would say both our rounds were very fast. Our pre-seed round, which is led by Primary Ventures. Primary was the very first investor that we were put in touch with and we closed the deal with them. So that was an outlier though. Yeah, that was really weird.
That is.
We weren't anticipating that, but we really hit it off. So we just went for it. Our seed round, we only spoke to, you know, probably single digits, maybe a dozen or something different investors, but like, you know, that's still a lot smaller than you'd expect. I'd say a typical round, you talk to between 50 and 100 funds.
Yeah.
That one, we probably also got lucky, but we also did our homework, you know, in advance. So like the person who led the round was actually Bain Capital, the fund who led the round was Bain Capital Ventures. And we started talking with Bain Cap the week that we closed our pre-seed. It was our first introduction, I think. You know, we were introduced to them and we were like, oh, we already got the pre-seed closed. It's like too bad. And we're like, let's stay in touch for the seed. And they're like, absolutely. You know, we just did shot call, you know, next time we talk, we're going to have this done in our product. It's like, next time we done it done, we're going to, you know, grow revenues by 100%. And then we did it. Next time we done it, like, so we just kind of like would always say what we're going to do and then do it. And, you know, we checked in, you know, every quarter or so for another 4 or 5 quarters. And then we said, all right, let's do the seed. And by the time the seed had come around, we both knew each other really well. So it's important. Both directions is important there. You know, they knew us. We knew them, which is also really important. We'd done this with, like I said, just a handful of funds that were all kind of, you know, ready to go. And, you know, we like being at the best and we still want to work with you. And then they just closed it. So like it was a very fast, easy process because we had been, you know, that built up that trust and that reliability of, you know, calling shots, making shots over the past year, basically.
And what it, like you're saying, and you guys know, we brought on other people who've raised funds and, you know, they always like, oh man, it was a sprint. Some people did it in 30 days, but they saw 100 people, right? And they were burnt out. And some people did it over the course of like a year. And for me, I only went and saw maybe 5 VCs. And the 5 VCs were interested, but this is before the pandemic, right? So they were just like, you're too early. And I'm like, I'm not too early. I'm doing this right now. I'm buying properties remote. But they didn't think people would buy properties sight unseen. And then 6 months later, everyone was buying properties sight unseen because of the pandemic, right? So it's just like, what happened, right? So after that, I never raised funds again, but now we're in the process of raising funds. So we've only talked to a handful of people, like you said, and it's going well so far. So it's really rare for that to happen. But if you've done your research and you have the data points, like you're saying, and you try to build those relationships, it kind of makes it easier, but not. So like, what's your advice to somebody that does have a startup who is trying to raise funds? Because obviously the path is not going to be as fast as yours. Do you think they should wait until they reach a revenue point, or do you think they should go in? Because you guys probably weren't at revenue yet. You probably just had an idea. So how'd that work for you guys?
Yeah, if you're talking to the pre-seed, I would not worry too much about revenue. When we did a pre-seed, I actually underestimated this. I when it was all these projections, like, is that we're going to make money? And here's the product. Like, just lots of, you know, planning basically to try and make us look bigger than we were. We were just like a couple dudes, basically. And I thought when Primary like said, all right, we're gonna back this, and all of the other investors came in and backed it, I was like, yes, they all bought it. Like they actually, you know, they bought this stuff. Looking back, I realized they didn't buy it at all. They're like, all right, this guy built a big plan, like bigger than he was with the spreadsheet or whatever. And they knew that immediately. You know, that was not like surprising for them at all. But they still invested, because at that stage, I underestimated. It's really just about two things at that stage: the team and the town. You know. It's 80% team, 20% tag. A big enough market, but it's really this team, everything's going to dramatically change about this product, about this company, about everything. It's going to be totally different. But the question that those previous investors are asking themselves is, are these people the ones to do this? Are they going to, right, you know, figure all that stuff out? And that's really why they invested, if they just liked us and they saw something in us, basically. So no, revenue is not important. The only other advice I'd say, two other quick pieces of advice before we wrap up here. One is, know if you, you know, maybe you don't want to fundraise at all. There's a huge amount of businesses that shouldn't be venture-backed businesses. So like, there's good and bad about it.
Why should they not? Why should they not raise? Elaborate on that. That's a good point. Because I didn't raise and we hit 2 million. So go ahead.
There you go. So yeah, that's the thing is like, once you raise venture capital, your business exists to be sold, right? You know, you've made a contract with the investors and their business model is to buy and sell business. So like, correct, your goal is to be sold. And you have to achieve hypergrowth. You know, it's like the venture business model only works if you have a hypergrowth ready business. And in fact, hypergrowth achieving business at the end of the day. But so if you don't have, maybe some people don't have the TAM, or there's just too much internal friction or too much internal inertia, like something in the business itself that makes it, you know, hard to achieve that hypergrowth. If you go out and successfully raise venture and you can't do that, then you're just setting yourself up for a world of hurt. And whereas if you have a great, maybe there's a lot of businesses that don't have hypergrowth that are fantastic businesses that you could have just run without raising venture capital and not had hypergrowth and had an amazing time with it. So I'm not even saying one's better than the other. I'm just saying know if your business is suitable for venture capital or not. Mm-hmm. And if not, just go and build a great non-VC business, build a great bootstrap business, which I have a ton of respect for. The last piece of advice I'll give is, most founders, there's three questions you have to answer in any funding round, right? It's like, why is this a big problem? Why are we the right team to solve it? And why now? I feel like everyone does a pretty good job of the first two. They focus on the first two, but they don't do a good job of the why now, right? So you need to have a narrative that articulates why people haven't been able to do this in the last, 30 years of tech that you could do differently than they can, right? And it's like, has there been a platform shift? Has there been a regulatory shift? Has there been new technological developments, like, you know, what has changed that make this a viable startup that, you know, wasn't a viable startup when the incumbents are trying to do this, you know, 3, 5, 7, whatever you used to go.
I like that. Why that makes sense. Yeah, no. And that's, we did good on all three just because it's remote real estate investing. And, you know, if you live in Miami or you live in Canada, you know how the cost of a house, how much that is, right? And you can buy a house in Memphis for $100,000, right, as an investment property, but you can't do that in Miami. And you for sure can't do that in Canada. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
But he brings up a good point. I will say this, you know what I mean? Like, I bootstrapped my business and it did reach a point of where it's a good business, right? But if you want to get exponential growth and you want to reach more people, sometimes you need that injection because it could take a lot longer with you bootstrapping than you just being able to take $1 million and dump it into marketing. So I think it depends on what you want to do and what kind of flexibility you want to have, because once you go raise funds, depending on the amount and depending on how many board seats you give up, depending on how much equity you give away, that could potentially turn into a job. So in your situation with you raising funds, did it seem like it turned into a job, or you were able to keep the free time to do what you want?
We've been lucky like that. I mean, well, I guess we've been thoughtful like that. So like, we're not for us because we have amazing people around the table. We've been very thoughtful about who we've decided to partner with. I think that's the key to managing that too, is like, you know, the average startup investment, I think from pre-seed is something like 9-10 years now. Mm-hmm. The average marriage lasts for 7. So this is not just a marriage. This is longer than a marriage, you know? So like you're choosing life partners here, and you got to make sure they're people that you really respect, that you know you're going to be able to work with for a long, long time. And I think that's the key to not making it feel like a job.
I'll pick it back up that really fast. And then I got one more question for you. Do you think people, if they're capable, because it's really hard running a business by yourself, I enjoy it because I don't have to answer anybody. I don't have to do all these different things, but it is a lot of work. I feel like I'm 8 people. I go to sleep at 3. Sometimes I wake up at 8, right? 3 a.m. waking up at 6. Like, it all depends on what you got going on. Do it. Like you just said, it's beyond a marriage, right? This is a life partner in essence until you can either get acquired, IPO, or decide to give them the business. Do you think people should try to start a business on their own or just try to find somebody they really connect with and get that business going?
Yeah, 100% find a co-founder.
Yeah, I've heard that.
This was actually funny. This was YC's policy was actually only invested in co-founders for a long time. I don't know if they might not still do that anymore, but for a long time, they only invested in co-founder powered startups. I think it's pretty essential. You know, like, startups are a roller coaster ride, and having someone to share that journey with you makes it 10 times easier for sure. So yes, find yourself a co-founder.
I don't know
if you have a co-founder or not. If not, go find one.
I don't have one. And at this point, I'm like, I'm probably 5 or 6 years in, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to get one. It would be great if I had one, but I'm like, they would have to come to the table with a lot of something. Right? Because the product is already out, it's going. You know what I mean? So it's just, at this point, it would be like getting a CMO or someone like that, not giving up any kind of equity because it's kind of too late. But if you are starting out, like you said, get a founder, get a co-founder, get a partner or something like that, depending on your level of business.
100%. Yeah. I think it's a great idea. I mean, it's the diversity of skills for starters, diversity of viewpoints helps make better decisions. And if nothing else, it's like emotional support. It's hard to build startups, what it is. And like doing it alone just makes it a lot harder. So good on you for getting there. You're right. You're over the hump now. But you did what a lot of people can't. So well done, sir.
And the thing about the emotional support, and then I'm going to ask you my last question. You're going to want to give up. Like, it gets so hard. It's because when you're an entrepreneur, it's like a solo journey if you don't have a partner, because you're spending a lot of nights by yourself. You're not going out. You're not partying. You can't spend money. There's like 1,000 things you can't do. And then eventually you hit a wall, and you just got to have the mental toughness to be able to get through that wall, or have a therapist, or have someone that you can speak to. because it is tough, man. That's the misconception.
Yeah, totally. One of the most successful people I know, he started a really successful business back in Canada. He was kind of like a mentor to me. And I remember before I started any businesses, he was like, you know, Ryan, there was a guy that like sat on the steps outside like my business. And when I walked in the door every morning to go start my day, and every day he just had a check and he's like, yeah, I'll buy your business. I'll buy your business for whatever. And like, so like, you know, he waves the check at me. I'll bet you, you know, one day a week, I would be walking up those steps and I would have been like, yeah, okay, all right, let's do it. So like, and I didn't understand really what it meant at the time. And I was like, yeah, but that's so true. You know, it's up and down. You got to have sort of emotional stability, and you got to be prepared for like a real, like, it's like a bucking bronco. It's a roller coaster ride. You got to be prepared for pretty wild swings where in the same day, you know, you can go from being like, you know, we're genius masks to the universe to like, we are total idiots. I have no idea what we were thinking. And yeah, you got to be able to get through that and just keep, you know, avoid those highs and lows and just manage to keep on that. You know, the important axis is not the Y axis, it's the X axis. Just keep going forward.
I'm laughing so hard because like last week, I'm like, I'm going to sell my business. I'm looking online for private equity firm to buy the company. And then I had a meeting today with a VC to fund the company. So it's like you said, in one day you can be like, you know what? I'm tired. I'm done. And then the next morning you wake up like, you know what? I slept great. I think I'm going to keep this going.
Totally.
So then
100%. Wild ride.
How do you get people? I know you were an advisor to a couple of startups. How does someone get you on their board, or are you interested in doing something like that now that you are a CEO?
Yeah, I still advise the startups from time to time. If you want to do that, I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, have a fit with me. So like, you know, if you're looking for someone, if you're in data analytics, if you're like a big nerd or like whatever it is, like, If there's a good reason to hit me up, then that's the best, you know, that's what it makes sense for you to advisor. I can't tell you anything about your, I don't know, whatever, your health tech business or your pharmaceutical business. Like, I have no clue, you know, so, but if it's a bit, hit me up. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. You know, Ryan Jansen is the name. It's LinkedIn. I think Jansen Ryan, or just Ryan Jansen on Twitter. Just search for Ryan Jansen. You'll find me sort of yammering about data on both those platforms.
I like it. I'm a nerd too, man. I'm like a semi-nerd. Like I'm into all of that stuff. I just don't code that well. Not for like mobile apps and things like that. At least I always ask this question to everybody. Give me two books that people can read to get to where you are, because it's a mindset at the end of the day. No one arrives to this point and make it to this point without having the right mindset. So two books.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, okay, so the first book I'm going to say, it's funny, I'm recommending, partially because we talked at the very start of this conversation, we're going to come full circle. You should read Peter Thiel's book, From Zero to One.
Mm.
And I think unfortunately, like, you know, identity politics, clear wellness, and like, he's a controversial figure now, yeah. But I think he has a lot of good, you know, regardless of politics, he has good ideas about business. And I think he's very articulate about how to think about startups in that book. I think it's a great read. And I think he's obviously a smart guy. So I definitely read From Zero to One. The other book, which I love recommending, which is completely under the radar, is a book called Storyworthy by Dix. Storyworthy is just, this is a guy who won the Moth Story Slam competition in New York. It's like a storytelling competition. And he's an excellent storyteller. And it's a funny thing to... it's an unexpected choice for like a startup book, I suppose. But when you're running a startup, everything you do is sales, you know, whether you're selling to people to join the team or you're selling, you know, to investors or potential investors, or you're selling your product, it's all sales. And storytelling is at the heart of sales. So yep. Reading that book actually makes you kind of better at every little part of your business. And there's a lot to take away from it. It's like an information dense book and a great read. So I would say my two choices, From Zero to One by Peter Thiel, and Storyworthy by, I think, Matthew is his name, Dix.
I like it. I like both of those. I haven't read Peter Thiel's book and the other book you're talking about. When you deal with a marketing person, they always say, tell the story. When you're trying to raise funds from a VC, they always say, tell the story. So you got to be able to tell the story in order to get customers, get funding, and basically sell your business to anybody.
Yeah, 100%.
Brian. 100%. Man, thank you for coming on. We're obviously going to be in touch because of obvious reasons.
Yeah, I nailed the sale. Look at that. That's great. Yeah, awesome chat, dude. Thanks for having me. And yeah, let's definitely connect offline. I'm sure you have a lot of great things to talk about. Founder.
For sure, man. And we have Investing Uncensored Roundtable. We bring together some of the guest speakers that we have on the show. And we have a roundtable where you have 3 minutes to answer the questions. And we fire them off. It's pretty cool. So... hopefully you'll join us on our roundtable sessions where you can deal with other VCs and founders that came on.
Totally. Bring it on.
All right, Ryan. Thanks for coming on, man. We'll be in touch.
Thanks, Don. Take care.
All right.